The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Welcome to the Space Show. 90 minutes of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here's your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Welcome to the Sunday Space Show, and this is your host, Dr. David Livingston. It's great to be here on another beautiful day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope it's as nice where you are. And as always, we appreciate your listening in and participating in the program. Quickly, just a few announcements for you. We welcome you to give us a call to give questions or comments to our guest today, Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya from Rutgers University, or just a comment in general. We have the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, available. Remember, no call screeners here. Let the phone ring until it can be answered, and you're immediately on the air. For those of you listening outside the United States live, this is an MCI toll-free number, so contact your MCI operator, and you should be able to connect to this wherever you are. If you want to get in touch with us by email, use either dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And if you prefer chat, we can work with either AOL's IM or ICQ. That screen name is Space Show Chat, all one word. Don't forget to visit the website, thespaceshow.com. This program and all others are going to be and will be archived there. You can listen to them whenever you want. And you can also visit the Space Show store. And if you feel like we do, that exploring space, developing space commerce, becoming spacefaring is important, join with the Space Show. Support us and helping us continue with this effort. Just click on the Support the Space Show button, and we appreciate any help that you can give us. And then finally, special great thanks to Lou Gentile and the IBC Radio Network for putting this program out on his network as well as on International Shortwave. Our guest today has been on the Space Show before. It is Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya. He is a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Rutgers University. Dr. Ben-Arroya is also a noted lecturer in national and international space conferences. He is a strong space advocate, and he just returned from an important new conference, one in Houston, by the way, and one in New Mexico, so we'll get some updates on that. He has received both his Ph.D. and his Master's in Engineering from the University of Pennsylvania, and he has very unique special interests, which include the modeling of space and lunar-based structures, space business and technology transfer, as well as the economic and political factors that affect space commerce and actually putting settlements or colonies on the moon. And he is working on a program for offshore structural dynamics. He has several books published in that subject, and there is, in fact, a new program at Rutgers that is going to be opening soon that talks about structures in extreme environments, and certainly the moon would be considered an extreme environment. So if the president's space policy actually gets implemented and we go to the moon, I think, Dr. Ben-Arroya, you're going to be a busy engineer. Is that right?
That's right, David. First of all, it's great to be on the show again.
Well, welcome, and thank you for coming back on.
My pleasure. I think so. We've been talking to a lot of people. A lot of people have called us since the president's speech, and the president's speech certainly has sparked great enthusiasm. And I think all of us on the technical end of things are certainly holding our breath, hoping that the political climate is conducive to that kind of return to the moon.
Do you think that, we might as well just get right into the president's space policy. I mean, certainly in the advocate community, we definitely want to return to the moon. We want to go on with humans to Mars. We see the incredible benefits, not just for our country and nation, but for humanity and the world in total. What do you think the chances are for some form of this policy to be implemented on a reasonable time scale?
I think the odds are better than 50-50 that it will be implemented. Of course, that's all guesstimates, but I think that there is now an emerging consensus that some sort of activity in space is beneficial to not only space scientists and engineers, but also to all of us, whether we know anything about space or even care anything about space. I think the return on investment is significant. And slowly but surely, I think there are more and more people who believe that.
Do you think that Congress is going to pick up the ball here? Do you think NASA is going to pick up the ball and really strongly advocate it? Is it up to the advocates to drive the benefits and the points home? Where is the energy going to come from to make this happen? Because I don't think it's going to happen by remote control.
Well, I agree with you there. I think, though, that the real energy has to come from the president. I think Congress is not going to be cohesive enough. I mean, there are supporters of space in Congress, but I think there have always been supporters of space in Congress, and nothing much got done, really, beyond what we see now with the space shuttle and the space station, and even those have had difficulties. I think one can certainly see the excitement just by virtue of the president's speech, and I think that's where the political will has to come through. The president has to be able to and willing to expend political capital making his case and convincing the average guy that, sure, it's expensive, but the benefits are huge, not only for him but for his children and for his grandchildren. That's where we have to look to see. I think we'll know if this is going to happen by virtue of what the president says and does over the next year and if he's reelected afterwards.
You know, of course, he didn't mention the space policy at all in the State of the Union address. Do you draw any conclusions from that, or is that just politics?
I was disappointed by that, really. I thought he should have, because the vision that he presented on his space speech was certainly dynamic and very detailed, and it should have at least found its way to a couple of sentences at the State of the Union. So that's not a good sign, although not necessarily a bad sign. I think we have to just wait and see.
I get quite a few emails a week from people who are of the opinion that they don't want to see us having any kind of a sizable space program, not so much because they hate space, but because they say there are people starving here and around the world, and that should be our first responsibility, or they may pick medical research or prescription drugs or whatever it is. But literally, I'm picking up anywhere from maybe 7 to 10 such notes a week. Do you think that that is really a vocal part of the American society, and when push comes to shove, they're going to be the ones writing the letters to their congressmen and to people to avoid having increases into the space program, or do you think there'll be sort of a silent group and the space advocates might prevail if they can get to the right people at the right time?
Well, I think there are always a group of people who are always only looking out for themselves, and certainly we have many problems on Earth, but I think the reality is that we'll have many problems always on Earth, and if we wait for the last person not to be hungry or clothed, then we won't be doing anything at all. We do have already a major program in health research. I mean, NIH is hugely funded, as are NSF and many other government labs. So I think that space, what we spend on space, is really hardly noticeable in the $2-plus trillion budget of the U.S. economy, the U.S. budget. So I think that space advocates alone can't do it, because we're basically the ones who have always been pushing it. I think it's very important that as individuals who support space, that whenever we have the opportunity, that we speak to people who may not know very much about space and explain to them why they would benefit from it. And I think we basically need to inform people about the realities of the space program and how it isn't as expensive as it might seem, given the benefits it might accrue. I don't think the space advocates can do it alone. I think we need to just start speaking out and making sure people understand the real issues and not be swayed by false analogies or basically statements that, well, you know, that they're hungry people, so how can we spend all this money going into orbit?
Of course, that assumes that if we don't spend the money going into orbit, we're going to actually put it into feeding hungry people, but that isn't usually the way government works.
No, not at all.
You mentioned the magic word, Professor, and that is benefits. So this crowd that sends all these emails in to me and quite a few other Americans say, what are the benefits? The benefits I need are a job, prescription drugs, medical insurance, food, clean air. What do you see as the benefits for us going on to the moon again, going into using the space station as a space training jumping off point, such as what President Bush suggested, and then going on with humans to Mars? What would you tell Joe and Mary Sixpack the benefits are for them by doing this?
There are so many technologies that have to be developed and improved upon for us to be able to get back to the moon. In many areas, for example, one area that we would have to perfect, and our understanding is in the area of human physiology. We don't really know how people would survive long-term in space from various things such as bone loss to just all kinds of cardiovascular issues.
Let me stop you right there. Why do you say we would have to perfect that technology to go back to the moon? We went to the moon once, and we didn't know anything about these technologies. It was sort of on-the-job training. Why do we have to perfect what we know in order to get back? And I don't think the Chinese are trying to perfect anything to get to the moon.
Well, when we went to the moon the first time, we knew that we were going for very, very short stays. We're talking about a couple of days travel, maybe a day or two on the moon, and then the same travel back. And so during that short period of time, we really were taking big chances because, as you said, we didn't know many things. We learned a lot, but we also knew that it was a very short stay. With the Russian Mir and with our efforts on Skylab and now our space station, people are going to be spending months and months in space. And if we go to the moon, we're talking, again, 6 months, 1 year stays, maybe some people eventually permanently staying on the moon and eventually on Mars. And that's a whole different game. And so we really need to know long-term implications of living in low-gravity environment or changes in gravity as you go from Earth to microgravity in orbit and then to 1/6 gravity on the moon. There's a lot to learn. And so we did learn a lot during Apollo. Many of the medical technologies and many of our physiological understandings emanate from that effort. So that's why I think we need to know much more, and not only human but also plant physiology. We're going to have to use plants for food, for oxygen creation. So there's a lot of stuff we have to learn, biological things we have to learn, as well as engineering kinds of technologies.
And so perfecting those technologies here on Earth with money being spent here on Earth is a benefit to Joe and Mary Sixpack.
Absolutely. So as we understand more about human physiology, some of these things get translated into better understanding of people on Earth, better technologies developed for life support system in space gets translated into other technologies on Earth, new materials, new ways to manage large infrastructures. All sorts of technologies come into play as we focus on that target as our goal. In addition, I think that a case can be made that a major new economic system would evolve by virtue of a large presence in space. Just as when going back to the time when Americans went west, you know, that was a similar kind of adventure. There was nothing there. Why spend money to go west, et cetera, et cetera? But meanwhile, the wealth that was created by just the adventure of going west led to many other things, led to whole cities being created, whole new industries being created, and that benefits everybody. Because if we're talking about jobs and economic well-being of individuals and families, then how do we create new jobs? We don't create new jobs by saying, here, the government says, here's some new jobs. We create new jobs by doing new things. And so every time somebody starts a company or starts a new venture, new jobs are created. And certainly space would be a huge venture, and it's beyond aerospace. It's everything. The whole economy would feed into a space adventure. And so that would create jobs, that would create new technologies, that would create new knowledge.
Okay,
that benefits everybody.
Let me stop you real quick before we go to another benefit, because I have this email comment and question. I think this is a really opportune time to bring it up. It's from Richard in Toledo, Ohio, and he says, please ask your guest about the following. This is a highly political year, and on the Democratic side, one of the main issues that we're being bombarded with is the exporting of jobs to other countries such as India and China. And my state has been particularly hard hit by this. We're hearing it all the time. So the question is, were the president's space policy program to be implemented along the timetable the president has suggested, would the job creation that you're talking about be available to help people in today's world, or are we talking about helping the children of today's people?
I would say both. Certainly, it would be a long-term thing, but we're seeing already NASA starting to restructure, starting to do studies on what needs to be done. And as those studies become plans and become funded, then things will happen. And so initially, it will start with, in the near term, more aerospace engineering kinds of jobs. But every dollar spent might generate multiples of that in supportive industries. So I think in the near term, it would be a small group of jobs, relatively small group. But as this goes forward, one would see a ripple effect that would basically start creating jobs for everybody that is somehow tied to the return to the moon and to Mars.
I don't know what the makeup of the aerospace industry or support industries are for Ohio, so I certainly can't address that part of Richard's question. But what do you think the likelihood is of the type of jobs being created that we're talking about today by a new revised space program of the United States being outsourced? Is that the type of job that would be outsourced, or do you think these would stay within the United States?
I think initially the bulk would have to be here, because the main players are going to be people, companies in the U.S., Boeing-type companies, Martin Marietta-type companies. I think these companies are the ones that are going to be actually building the equipment, just as they are a space station. But by virtue of the magnitude of the space adventure, and because it is an international activity, one would certainly expect foreign companies to come in, and these may be multinational efforts. However, the United States is still at the forefront of space technology, and we're really the leaders as of today in many of these technologies. And I think that any return to the moon and eventually Mars would really build our industries here. But I think it's not possible to completely partition any activity with only American jobs. I mean, even the car that we buy has parts built in other countries. So I think that's how the space, the return to space would play here as well.
Benefits for going to Mars with humans, what do you see for that?
I think that's a much, much longer-term thing. I'm a proponent of going to the moon first, developing technologies, learning, getting our walking feet on the moon, because it's close, it's 3 days away. We know it better than Mars. Mars is at least 9 months away. Once you send somebody to Mars, they're pretty much on their own no matter what happens. We don't know how to build technology that can work reliably for several years, guaranteed. And if people's lives are at stake, then we don't want to do that until we really know what we're doing with going back to the moon. But I think eventually that the moon is only a stepping stone. So Mars really should be viewed as a first step to really creating a civilization of humans outside of Earth. And so I think that if one is looking at this in a very visionary way, one can see us colonizing Mars, some of the outer planets perhaps, as our technologies become better. Basically, I think the larger vision is that people will be traveling the solar system, mining asteroids, setting up cities on the moon and Mars, and maybe some of the Jovian moons. Who knows? But I think we need to look at this as an ongoing process that really does not end, no more than our expansion to the West ended. We didn't go to California and then packed up and went back to New York. We stayed there. And so I think that's how one should view the humanization of the solar system.
You know, space show listeners are really treated to a special thing with you as a guest today, because for whatever reason, the space show has a lot of guests that are policy people and business people, but we don't get very many real hardcore, solid, total engineers that know the difference between hype and solidity in an engineering structure. And you do. I mean, not only do I know that from your position at Rutgers, but I know you as a personal friend. So from an engineering point of view, and no more, you know, BS from the policymakers and the wishful thinkings and the advocates that want everything to happen and think we can do it, are we technically capable, first of all? Do we have the engineering know-how right now, today, to return to the moon? Do we have engineers that can go bring out what NASA did and understand it and replicate the engineering and the safety and the technical prowess? Or how much of the wheel do we need to reinvent?
Well, the short answer is yes. We do know what we need to know to get back to the moon, which doesn't mean that there aren't technical issues to solve. I mean, we don't want to rebuild the Saturn or the Apollo, which is 40-year-old technology. We want to take advantage of everything we've learned in those 40 years and recreate a modern version of the Apollo program. The answer is that we do know how to do this. It's pretty much always been politics that has stopped our return to the moon. I mean, there are technical issues, of course. It's still very expensive to bring weight into orbit. It's very expensive because that's how our technology, propulsion technology, is. But the bottom line is we do know how to get back to the moon. We do have knowledge about how to build structures there. We know how to do life support. We know how to build rovers that can traverse the moon. And I think that's why the moon is an attractive first stop. It's something that is doable, and it'll take on the order of 5 to 10 years, and we can have people on the moon again.
Okay, so let's fast forward, and it's later in 2004, and we actually have a heavy lift vehicle. We don't have to worry about how we're going to get to the moon. That is a given. So we don't have to prove that. We don't have to deal with that. So now we have a space commerce company that has its funding. We don't have to worry about that. It's got all the funding it needs to do whatever it wants. Do we have, A, the engineering and technical know-how for that private company to get to the moon and, let's say, build a space tourist hotel on the moon, and, two, do something like mine Helium-3?
I would say that we need some development. I mean, we don't have off-the-shelf technology. We need rockets that can not only bring us into orbit, we stipulated that they exist, but now we need some sort of rockets that would take us from Earth orbit, be able to land us on the moon safely. And if we're talking about the next 5 to 10 years, we really are talking about first-generation lunar bases, which are basically like tin cans that we would bring land, and then we would have to shield them from the radiation, micrometeorites that one finds on the lunar surface because of the lack of atmosphere. I don't think we're ready to do full-scale mining. I think one has to sort of separate first-generation lunar activities, which is where we are going to be at first, obviously, and second-generation, which means that once we're in second-generation, we can actually manufacture on the moon. We can do larger-scale mining. We're doing more than just life support. The first generation that we will all see probably in the next 10 years or so will be people landing there, setting up very simple facilities, more trying to survive than actually build anything. I think we need to think maybe 20 years downstream, once we have that first base there for 5 years or so, to start actually building a infrastructure, an industrial infrastructure with it, where we can actually mine the lunar regolith or the lunar soil for that helium-3 or for other precious materials that we can make things from.
What do you think the Chinese can do if they get to the moon? Can they... if they get there in 3 or 4 years, is their engineering ability, their technical ability, significantly different from ours one way or the other? Will they be able to do more than us, or will they be sort of repeating 2 or 3 day Apollo-like visits?
I think they would be repeating Apollo because we still are quite more advanced than anybody else on the planet as far as space technology. We do have a lot of experience in space. Except for the Russians, who have a lot of experience in Mir, nobody has as much experience in space or has advanced technology as we do, certainly in electronics areas. The Chinese, I think, will have a very hard time to get to the moon at this stage of the game. They certainly will eventually have the ability to do what we did, but they're not anywhere near where we are. So I think if anybody can go back to the moon, it's really us. Certainly the European countries have major technological skills, and I think that we basically have to do some of the similar steps that we did in Apollo, but it's at a much higher, more modern level than Apollo.
Let me see if I can work where we are with lunar structures into a terrestrial example, and you know, maybe it might make it a little bit easier for some people to really get a clear picture of where we are. One of my favorite engineering and structural topics to look into, just for my own self, is the history of what happened in concrete construction, and then applying it into these big, gigantic dams like Hoover Dam, which was in the early 30s, and then Lake Powell, Glen Canyon Dam, and some of the other dams that used this type of concrete with steel bar reconstruction. And I happen to have a very close friend in San Francisco who's a phenomenal architect, John Winder, who also happens to know the history and the methods of structural engineering. So he helps take me through all of this and understand what was so monumental about being able to build Hoover Dam in the early 30s with cooling pipes, with the way the concrete was actually made, with the way the steel was put in it, which was very different from before, which allows Hoover Dam to do its job. So when we go back to the moon to build structures for commerce, for tourism, for people to stay, are we sort of like we were in the early 1930s, learning how to do very new things with existing materials, which is what they did with Hoover Dam? Or are we at a completely different level that even way outshadows what was going on with that kind of innovative construction, which made Hoover Dam such a unique and famous and one-of-a-kind structural accomplishment?
I think there is some of what you describe about Hoover Dam with the return to the moon and lunar structures. We do have to take existing knowledge and existing technology and use it in a very different way. I think where the difference happens is that not only are we doing something very different by building a lunar structure, but we're also building it in an extremely hostile environment. Now, certainly where the Hoover Dam was built was a hostile environment. There was a lot of things that had to be worked out before one could actually build a dam. But that pales by comparison to the hostile environment of the lunar surface. Our first construction workers on the moon will be basically astronauts in astronaut suits. As well developed as robotics is today, robots cannot build a lunar base. Only people can build a lunar base as we speak. So the construction environment on the lunar surface is extremely severe. It's very unforgiving. Any accident is a fatal accident. So I think whereas we are doing new things in building a lunar base, just as we are building the space station, the environment really adds a completely new dimension to what we're trying to do.
Will we pretty much know the properties of the materials that we're working with on the lunar base because of our experience with space stations?
The lunar base will be a different kind of structure than space station. Space station is a very large, flexible framework kind of structure. It's basically orbiting the Earth. So a lot of the issues that one has when building on a planetary surface don't happen there. I would say the fact that we have to put the structure on the lunar soil, the regolith, means that we have to understand the lunar surface better, just as we do on Earth to build a foundation. We have to do that as well on the lunar surface. So there are similarities, and there are great benefits to learning how to build in orbit for the space station. But it can be a different kind of construction sequence working on the lunar surface.
What about equipment that would be needed to build? Like, would you need steam shovels or something, space shovels? Or what would you be digging with on the lunar orbit doing the space station? Of course, you're not digging anything up to anchor anything into the foundation. Are you using piers like what they do in San Francisco with these huge high rises, you know, to anchor against earthquakes and stuff, right, where they pile drive these huge big piers? What are you doing on the lunar surface for engineering?
Well, initially we wouldn't have the kind of equipment that you described. We would not be able to pile drive things into the ground. We would not be able to do very much as far as earth moving because these are huge equipment. Initially, some of the preliminary concepts for an early lunar base would be either some inflatable structure. I've been working on a concept with a student of mine where we actually have arched B beams that would be carried up and then bolted together, and then we would inflate an interior structure, and then we would be able to pressurize that, and that would become the interior of an initial lunar base, on top of which we would place shielding. Now, obviously, we would never be able to move large quantities of lunar soil. It would have to be done very slowly over a long period of time, because just to bring heavy equipment to the moon might be even more costly than bringing the lunar base to the moon. So I think initially, again, for that first-generation lunar base, we would not be doing excessive construction or excessive manual labor. We would have to be able to bring things prefabricated, basically bolt them together, and that would be our first lunar base.
We're coming up on a break, but let me get this question, which just came in by email for James, who's in Boise. And he says, fascinating discussion. Tell me, would an arch structure on the moon be really strong like it is on Earth, or would the minor gravity that the moon has affect its strength?
The gravity would have no effect on the strength, because the strength of the arch is within its material and its geometry. So if anything, we would be able to have the same sort of strength with 1/6 the weight, because the gravity is 1/6 on the moon. So we could actually have similarly strong structures with much more lightweight components. So in effect, we'd be able to have very strong structures on the moon, and the gravity actually plays in our favor.
Okay, everybody, stay tuned to the Space Show. Our guest today, Professor Chaim Ben Arroyo from Rutgers University, will be back in about 2 minutes.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring the Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com. The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all mankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, economy, and our cosmic vision, one in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility in our off-Earth conduct and the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the reality of tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Sunday Space Show. This is your host, Dr. David Livingston. Our guest today, Professor Chaim Ben Arroyo in the Mechanical Engineering Department at Rutgers University. And we've been talking about lunar structures and space policy and some really great, interesting, cool subjects. Professor, we were talking when we were off the air during the break, but how likely is it for some of these structural things that we've been talking about to be produced on the moon by the private sector? Is there any way that a commercial profit-oriented company in the relatively near future could see an investment opportunity here and put their money up with a reasonable expectation of a profitable return?
I think it's possible if one stipulates inexpensive access to space. It's so expensive to go to the moon that one would have to have very deep pockets to make something commercially viable. Probably the only thing that might be commercially viable today would be helium-3 if we ever figured out how to do nuclear fusion, because then that would be worth its weight really crucial to understand that the government does have a role to create at least part of the infrastructure. That's been historically the case for almost any major explosion of activity in the U.S. or any part of the world. The government basically invests on behalf of all its citizens to create a framework within which industry can then go in and start creating new goods, creating wealth, creating jobs. So I think that's why it's important to realize, I know there are many who propose complete commercialization of space, and I certainly support commercialization of space, but that commercialization can only work with the investment of the national government on behalf of its citizens.
How well do you think that national investment psychology is understood by members of Congress and even NASA?
NASA, I think, is all over the place. And so while there might be some groups within NASA that understand it, there are other groups that don't understand it at all. I think Congress may understand it, again, individually. There's some individuals that do. But I think, you know, very few members of Congress have any vision beyond getting reelected and beyond their very special interest groups. So perhaps some congressmen who have a NASA facility or some space industry in their district or in their state might have some understanding. But I haven't heard very many express very visionary ideas about the future of the country, and not just space, but in other larger issues. So I'm a bit pessimistic on that, and I think that many times we are driven by emergencies or crisis management approach, and we see that all over the place, and space might be part of that as well.
Jump forward to structures on Mars. Is the engineering and the technology that will be needed radically different from what's needed on the moon, or is it just a minor or sort of a little step upward to have the same sort of stuff going on for Mars?
It's a relatively small step. It's a much larger step to get our first generation, second generation lunar bases.